Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome back to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm Linda P. Jones, your host this week from Be Wealthy and Smart. I'm so excited we have another episode of Listener Questions, one of your favorites and our favorites to do. And we also have a special guest with us, Devin Carroll from Social Security Intelligence. How you doing, Devin?
Awesome. Thank you guys for having me again.
Well, it's great to have you back. We enjoyed having you before a couple of times, and so this is your third appearance, right?
Well, at least I didn't ruin it.
No, you never ruin it. You gave us some really great advice. And we also have Doug Goldstein from Goldstein on Geld and Rich as a King, all the way from Israel. How are you, Doug?
I'm really doing well. I was trying to sound like I was far away. Now, with the internet, we are all so close to it. So that, did it sound like I was far away?
Well, you have to like do an echo, like, I'm doing well, well, well.
No, well, in the valleys of the shadow of death here in Israel. No, it's not like that at all. It is beautiful here. Although it is funny, when my mother is here, which she is now visiting, and then she calls my siblings in the States, she always just talks so much louder because she feels like it's got to get overseas. So that was my joke before. Things are great.
And the lovely Miranda Marquette from Planting Money Seeds and Adulting.tv. How are you, Miranda?
I'm doing okay. I'm out of town, which is nice. I do have somebody staying in my house, so it's kind of a fun thing. We're trying something new.
So are you telling us this is like an Airbnb kind of a thing, or are you just warding off all would-be robbers?
Yeah, no. Somebody, I had an opportunity where somebody was like, hey, I need a place to stay, just like a short-term rental. Do you know, have any ideas? And I just said, well, because they were going to be in town temporarily. And they're like, I just need a short-term rental. Do you have any ideas? And I said, well, I'm going to be out of town. If you want, I can be your short-term rental.
So, perfect. I love it when a plan comes together and you can make a little extra cash.
I know,
perfect.
Right?
Yes. I love it.
It's not a lot of extra cash, but it'll cover the rent for the month that I'm gone. So it's perfect.
Well, that's perfect. That's great. Well, hey, Miranda, as long as we're chatting with you, could you tell us a little bit about our episode sponsor, the Buzz Index?
Right. Of course, the Money Tree Investing Podcast is currently sponsored by the Buzz Index. Have you ever wondered if there is a way to capitalize on all the online chatter of millions of individuals on social media? Well, you can, because the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds are now available to you with the Buzz Index. Advances in artificial intelligence and natural language processing enable investors to harness a vast data set to identify actionable investment insights about individual stocks. The way in which information is assembled to analyze companies and forecast stock prices has changed for good with the Buzz Index. You can invest in the Buzz Index and get the benefit of the wisdom of the crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and for more information. Also, it is worth noting that our own Joe Salcy, hi, invests in the Buzz Index. It's right for him. He really likes doing it, but it may not be right for you. So make sure you do your due diligence before you make that decision. Once again, that's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. And now back to you, Linda, because I am super excited to get into this listener question episode.
All right. Well, let's get started right away with Steph's question. She says, I am 40 years old and curious as to whether long-term health insurance should be part of my financial plan. If so, what is a good age to take out a policy and what are some of the things I should be looking for? Miranda, do you want to tackle that one?
Not really, but let's do it anyway. So I'm going to make assumption here that she means long-term care insurance, which is slightly different from health insurance. Everybody should have health insurance if they can. It's a good way to protect against catastrophic costs. And I personally know the value of health insurance. After I broke my wrist, the hospital bill was $40,000, but I only had to pay about $10,000 out of my pocket just because of the health insurance. So that's important to have. But I'm going to assume she means long-term care insurance. And this is the sort of insurance that you get if you think that you might spend some time in like an assisted living facility or a nursing home. Now, it's important when you're choosing these long-term care policies to make sure you understand what facilities it covers, because some will cover only full assisted living facilities where you actually have medical staff either on call or on premises, and they can be a little bit more expensive. A lot of the time, these long-term care insurance policies will not cover like your resident, like if you go to live in an active senior community or whatever, they won't cover that. So you need to make sure you know what kind of facilities it covers, whether it's a nursing home, an assisted living facility, or long-term care in a hospital. So make sure you understand what it covers ahead of time. And these get more expensive the older you get. So the older you are when you get your policy, the more expensive it is. Whether or not you need one kind of depends on how much you've managed to save up to this point. If you have a pretty sizable nest egg, you can basically self-insure. And if you set up your income in a way where between your retirement portfolio and your Social Security check and whatever else you, whatever other assets you have, if you've got them set up so that you can afford the monthly cost of living in one of these long-term care facilities, then the insurance isn't really necessary. And it is kind of a trade-off because you do have to balance how much it costs. If you are 40 years old right now, you can usually get a decent policy for a low cost. But the risks there is the insurance company could go bust. And some of these policies are a little better than scams. And I think Devin probably has more information on that as well.
Okay. Thanks, Miranda. That actually was very helpful and full of a lot of good information. So, Devin, do you have something to add to that?
You know, with long-term care insurance, it used to be that everyone was getting in the game and it was something that everyone should have in their portfolio. And that's what they were saying from the big investment houses. So you saw the big brokerage firms really pushing this stuff on their clients. And the truth is, at the core, it makes a lot of sense, right? So we insure our car, we insure our house, we insure all of this other stuff that has a very low statistical probability of occurring. I mean, I think losing our home to a fire is somewhere around 2%. It's very low. Needing long-term care is closer to 50%, and yet it's one thing that very few people insure. So just looking at it that way, it's easy to make the case for, okay, I've got all this other stuff insured. I need to make sure and have my long-term health care insured. The problem is, it's just not that easy. It's not as smooth as it is buying insurance for all of these other areas of your life. You know, the insurers jumped into the game, and then as longevity started to increase and they realized they may have bitten off more than they could chew, some of these companies started to exit the long-term care business. They started selling off the policies that they had, and now there's very few companies left that even do it. And those that still are issuing those policies have gotten very expensive. So it leads people to look at it and say, wait a minute, is it, you know, if I put all of this money into this, am I ever going to get back, you know, in benefits what I've paid in premiums? And a lot of people are making the decision to either take the chance or to self-insure.
Yeah, the costs are really quite large for long-term care, and it's hard to say all those years that someone could be in a facility, and certainly costs, you know, north of $50,000 are not unusual per year, so it's a big cost to insure. Doug, do you have a perspective on this from the financial planning angle?
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing just to keep in mind, and based on what Miranda had pointed out, she said, some people might want to self-insure. You're just basically saying if you're rich, you don't have to worry about it because you can pay for it on your own. And I think that's true that people can do that if they have a lot of money. However, one thing to keep in mind is if you're an older couple, and I don't know how many older couples actually listen to the show, but everyone's going to hopefully be there one day. Sometimes what happens is they have a lot of money and they say, oh, we'll be okay. And then one of them goes into a nursing facility and needs help for years and wipes out their nest egg, leaving the second to die bankrupt. So if this is your situation, you have to build this into a financial plan and think about the possibility of maybe extending your life insurance policy much later than you normally would have. Normally, people buy life insurance and they don't really need it once the kids get older. But if someone is going to be relying on their own money in order to pay for nursing care, then they have to combine that with the possibility of having a term life policy or a whole life policy that's going to go well into their senior years.
All right. Thank you. Our next question comes from Chris. Will you address the leveraged ETF? What makes them leveraged? If you invest in them, what percentage of your portfolio should you have? How popular are they? Thank you. Devin, it sounds like Chris wants to know all about leveraged ETFs. What can you tell him?
Well, first of all, I don't use them. And here's why. It's very simple. I don't do trading. The portfolios that we build are generally portfolios that we can buy and we can hang on to for a while. Leveraged ETFs are built for trading, and here's why. Generally speaking, they use borrowed money. And if you're buying a leveraged ETF, for example, that is 2 times the return of the Standard & Poor's 500, which is one of the more popular versions out there, then if the Standard & Poor's returns 10%, you get 20%. If it loses 10%, you lose 20%. So very simple, right? But this is why they are built for trading. You can't hold it long term, get to the end of the year and say, hey, the Standard & Poor's made 15% this year. That means I made 30%, right? That's wrong. Because if you think about it this way for a moment, if you have one of these investments and it goes up, let's say that today it goes up 10%, then you actually go up 20%. So assume that price of that ETF was 100. So now it's up 20%. It goes up to 120. The next day, it goes down 10% and you go down 20%. Well, 20% of 120 takes you back down to 96. So what should be an even wash day now puts you in the negative. And so if you hold that, that impact just really starts to erode your value. Again, I don't trade. I don't trade for my clients. We do buy and hold investing predominantly with some strategy built in, but these are not part of that strategy at all.
Exactly. They are something that is a trading vehicle. I think they are very popular just because they are something that are rather unique and people who are traders feel like they can take advantage of them. But you did a great job, Devin, describing why they're not a long-term hold, and I completely agree with that. How about you, Doug? What do you think about leveraged ETFs?
Well, I'm thinking of a story because just like Devin, I don't use them except I have one client who likes to trade them, and he always says, listen, I'm investing my money. I want to make more. I've made a decision. I believe something's going to happen, and I'm willing to bet on it. And so why not bet in a leveraged fashion? And leveraged ETFs, one of the benefits that about having and about trading them is they're really easy. It's just the same as buying a stock. And instead of having to deal with margin papers, margin is when you borrow money from the brokerage firm and use your stocks as collateral. You don't even need a margin account in order to trade leveraged ETFs. They do all the borrowing for you. The problem is everything moves at twice the speed. And I guess you could say that that's a good thing. It's like driving with your foot pedal to the metal all the time. It's true, you'll get there much faster. But in the event of a crash, it can be really explosive. And I will just tell you, the guy that I watch do this, and I've told him time and time again, I kind of hope he's listening. I've told him time and time again, I think this is a bad idea. I think, you know, you're not going to be right that much. You should invest in a long-term portfolio, the type of thing you can just hold on to, and it'll go up and down over time. Don't try to be so smart, because what will happen, and in this guy's case, what has happened, so I can tell you the personal experience of what I've witnessed, is that over the years, he's just literally lost money every year. He's not able to get ahead, and he would have been better just putting his money into CDs, but you know, certainly putting it into a managed account of broadly diversified ETFs would have done much better for him. But of course, he continues to do it, and you know, even though, and he says, well, Doug, past performance is no guarantee of future returns, like you always say, so maybe my luck will turn around.
Oh, dear. Well, it can get close to gambling. Some of these ETFs can actually be not only 2 times, but 3 times leveraged as well, which would mean, just like Devin's example, 3 times on the upside and 3 times on the downside. So you can see the volatility is pretty tremendous. And we all know Miranda is a buy and hold investor. But Miranda, do you have anything to add here?
No, I think the guy has covered it pretty well. yeah. I don't know. I have a hard time with leveraged anything. And ETFs can get pretty crazy up in there, especially if you're like doing something like a commodity ETF, where, ETFs are derivatives, right? They're not like things like that, that they're not actually investing in the thing you're investing in. And so leveraging on top of that makes it even worse. So if you've got things like commodities or futures that you're investing in a leveraged ETF with, then you're dealing with all sorts of problems and a special problem called contango that just really screw you up. So unless you really, really know what you're doing, it's better to just be boring.
Yeah. All right. Let's go on to Roberto. I just listened to your podcast about using debt as a tool to invest. Although you hinted about it, you forgot to emphasize that all investments have risk, and leveraging multiplies that risk to levels that, in a wrong environment, can lead to bankruptcy. Well, Roberto, we sometimes forget to advise people about risk, and absolutely, investing involves risk, using debt involves risk. Certainly, the ETFs we were just talking about, the leveraged ETFs, involve risk. So, yes, you're right. It is something that is good to remind people, and thank you for reminding us. Does anyone else have anything to add? All right, we'll move on to Will. Hey, guys, love the show. The opposing opinions on the panel give this show so much more depth and show more angles on decisions. Found you guys about 6 months ago and have now caught up on all episodes. I'm currently studying finance at the university in Australia and soon to graduate and enter my field. In Australia, our employer pays 9.5% of your pay into a retirement account called superannuation, which I'm sure you guys know. Well, actually, no, because we're not Australians, but thank you for telling us. My question lies with what option to choose. I completely understand that the time value of money is important, but seeing as I'm 23, should I be putting it into a more aggressive portfolio? The time value of money could be seen negatively and positively, seeing both losses and gains having a 40-year time period in this account. I'm unsure whether to change from my balanced option. Thank you so much, Will. Hey, Doug, what do you think? Should he go more toward equities or keep his balanced option?
Yeah, I'm definitely pro equities. I think, you know, when you're young, if you don't mind the risk, let's just say like this, statistically over the long term, over the next, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, you'll probably do much better in the stock market than in pretty much anything else. The one thing that a lot of younger people have to think about, though, is whether it's really true that all of the money they're talking about is going to be long-term money. In other words, if it turns out that they're going to, let's say, buy a house in 2 years or 3 years, and they need a big down payment, well, that money is not long-term. So I would begin, as you focus on your financial plan, to think about what the big expenses are going to be going forward, for example, buying a house, and then map it out. And the money that you see as long-term money, as long as you're comfortable with the risk and you understand that it might not actually grow for you, but if you're comfortable taking that kind of risk, I think it makes sense, certainly, from a financial planning standpoint.
Okay, great. Miranda, what do you think?
I agree with Doug. it just kind of for our thing, the superannuation, it's basically like paying into a pension like program, right? You pay in and it's supposed to pay you out monthly later down the road. But yeah, I agree with Doug. When you have a little more time and a little more opportunity and some time to grow that money, you're usually better off tilting a little more toward equities.
Devin, what do you think?
You know, I can't speak to Australia's system here, but I can speak to allocation in general. You know, he mentions being aggressive here. So a couple of things there. When we're in markets like we're in now, I find that there's a lot more people that's aggressive than there are when the market starts to get soft or starts to go down. All of a sudden, people realize that, hey, I'm not aggressive anymore. But I would say that I have seen people make better returns over the long term in not necessarily being aggressive, but in being in more of a moderate portfolio. So something that's tilted more towards a growth focus, you know, with that 70% equities range. And here's why. They don't tend to make up, or they don't tend to spend the good years making up losses from the bad years and get caught up in that cycle like a lot of super aggressive investors do. So he's mentioning being aggressive. If you look at the allocations on a lot of these retirement plans, they'll list the small cap funds and all of that in the aggressive strategy. But when people get in those, sometimes they figure out that their losses are so heavy in the bad markets that the good markets are just, you know, they're spending half that and, you know, getting their feet back under them. So I would tend to say focus on more of a growth allocation. To growth and income.
So when you say growth, just to define it, you're saying growth as opposed to aggressive because you mean that growth is some sort of asset allocation where a piece of the pie is in something safe, right?
Yeah. I think that I should probably explain that a little better. So if you're aggressive, I would say that you're all in stocks. If you're in a growth allocation, that's more of an 80% stocks, 20% fixed income to cash allocation. and then maybe even a 70-30. And then below that, you're going more into what I would class as a growth and income type investor, where you're maybe a 60-40, something like that. But I have found that that growth makes the most sense.
That sounds good. I'm just curious, because on paper, it's different if someone invests the money and simply doesn't touch it for years. In other words, I think Miranda's pointed this out on previous shows, that someone who, you know, puts his money into the market and just keeps it there forever is going to do whatever the market does, obviously. And the suggestion you're saying is it's kind of like riding with the brakes on a little bit. And I'm not talking about things where people mess themselves up and they sell when the market goes down and they buy when it goes high. I'm just talking like theoretically. Wouldn't it pay for someone who's a long-term investor to be 100% in?
You know, I don't know. If we could exclude human behavior out of the equation, you're probably
right. Let's exclude all humans, right?
Yeah. But we can't do that, and we know that. We're all going, especially as those balances get larger, right? So when we're dealing with a little bit of money, you know, if I have, it depends on how you define a little bit, right? But if you have 10,000, 20,000, 50,000, 100,000 in your retirement plan, and you're seeing 10%, 20% losses, it hurts, but it doesn't feel that bad. But then when you're getting up closer to that $500,000, $750,000, $1 million, and you're seeing a 20% loss, that's when people make irrational decisions. And that's at the worst possible time, too, you know, when they're probably getting closer to that retirement deadline. So I don't think it's possible to exclude human behavior out of it.
Well, I also want to say, Will, congratulations that your employer pays 9.5% of your pay into your retirement account. That's pretty awesome.
No doubt.
I think that's amazing. And at 23 years old, should you continue on that path for your entire life, you should, you know, if you have an aggressive account and assuming markets continue to perform as well as they have, you could really be seeing a pretty nice retirement account there. So good for you. All right, our next question comes from LC. Hello, I love your podcast, and I have learned tons about investing. In fact, I recently decided to listen to the very first episodes. I discovered your show at episode 90-ish, and I keep learning great things from information that is a few years old. Congrats to Miranda for being on the show since day one. Yay, Miranda!
Yay, Miranda.
And thank you for listening to our show, LC. That's awesome. And I see you're an engineer at a large corporation and you're 30 years old. You've got a couple of questions here. One is, should you buy stock shares of a certain company? Is it a good investment if the company has done well? Is it likely to be a good employer? In other words, can you use some of the tools that help identify good stocks for investment and assume these companies are likely to be good employers as well? What do you think about that, Miranda?
I think some of that stuff can help you figure out like the health of the company and whether or not it's financially stable. So you're going to be less likely to be laid off in the future. Like if you're looking at things like earnings and growth and stability, I mean, that can help you decide whether or not they're likely to be around in the future. The other thing though, is sometimes some of that stuff doesn't tell you much about the company culture and whether it would be a good fit for you and whether the company has the same kind of mission that you have. So it depends on what's important to you, the most important thing to you when you're looking for a job. And in a way, it can be because when you're looking at stock analysis and you're trying to decide what to invest in, you know, you want to make a list of like, what are the most important characteristics? What are you most looking for in the stock and figuring out which stocks match what you're looking for, whether that's PE ratio or profit margin or, you know, PEG or whatever the little numbers are that you're looking for. You can do the same thing when you're looking for an employer. You can say, okay, what's most important to me? Pay, benefits, company culture, company mission. Is it going to be a company that's going to be around for several years? So you can look at that and then use those kinds of characteristics to analyze what sort of employer and what sort of companies you kind of want to go after for employment down the road.
Mm-hmm. All right. Devin, what do you think?
You know, I'm worthless on this one. I'll tell you why. I've worked for myself exclusively for the last 15 years, and the two jobs I had before that were small companies. So when we're looking at basing the value of an employer based on their stock performance, I don't have a clue. I really don't. It would make sense that if they have strong earnings, that that could lead down the road to happy and content employees, but it may not. I don't know. Sorry, I'm worthless.
That's
guys.
All right. No problem. No problem. Perspective there. And Doug, how about you?
You know, Linda, I'm trying to think if we can apply the metrics that we look at when we look at certain investments and in certain areas. So I'd like to think, for example, that a company which is socially responsible, and I'm really reaching here because I don't have any evidence, that a company that's socially responsible might be a better place to work. And so therefore, we could say, are socially responsible investments better than socially non-responsible investments? You know, in other words, than other, let's say, the average company. And then maybe you could figure out whether it's a good idea to work for a company that is doing good and doing well. So I don't have an answer to the question, but that's a good place maybe if you want to start researching this. I also note that people don't always have the opportunity to choose, you know, exactly which company they're going to work for. And I'm definitely on Devin's side. I'm pro-entrepreneurship. You know, when you work for yourself, you have many, many clients, hopefully. And so if one of them fires you, you're okay. But when you work for a big company, no matter how good the company is, if they have a problem or they let you go, you're completely stuck. So my advice in general to people who have the spirit of an entrepreneur is to follow that path.
All right. Well, I'd say it's a starting point to look at a potential employer. Certainly a company that's doing well and its stock is doing well is probably growing and increasing in profitability over time. But I would say you also are going to want to look at it from a different perspective as an employee, because you're going to want to look at employee benefits and opportunity and growth and things like that, and what's happening in your local market. For example, are you in the area of the home office, or are you in more of a regional capacity with this company? So there's lots of different things to look at. I think it's one thing, maybe a starting point, but I wouldn't say that it's everything to consider when looking at a potential good employer. And your other question is about your current employer is reimbursing your tuition. And if you leave within 3 years after graduation, you'll owe $40,000 to $50,000 back to your current employer, or half of that if you leave within 2 years later. So once you graduate and look at new opportunities, if you owe $50,000 to your current employer and find an offer where you'd make an additional $50,000, it's a no-brainer. I should take the offer, assuming that the rest of the offer is good too, such as benefits, growth opportunities, etc. If it's only $3,000 more per year, I'm sure I couldn't accept this offer. But in between that, what would you think would be a good additional income to my current one? Well, I don't know if we can talk about your additional income, but I think Miranda might have some insight into reimbursement of tuition. What do you say, Miranda?
I just think that benefits, you really shouldn't discount the value of benefits a lot of the time, because they can be very helpful. And if you get these tuition benefits just by hanging out for another 3, 4, or 5 years, that helps a lot. That goes a long way, especially when it comes when you consider the way that student debt is really kind of weighing on a lot of people and getting their lives started. So, you know, as somebody who spent, like Devin and like Doug and like Linda as well, I've been self-employed for a very long time. And as somebody who spent years struggling without benefits and then suddenly had access to benefits, like, it's really hard to discount that. And I would be happy to take a bit of a pay cut just to have great benefits. So I still like having my own business. I still like doing my own thing. But I do remember, hey, you know, how wonderful and marvelous it was to suddenly have health, and also suddenly have health benefits, suddenly have matching 401k, all of that stuff. So if you aren't planning on striking out on your own, it might definitely be worth trading in a couple extra years of your time just to get that tuition reimbursement benefit, because that is fairly valuable.
You know what's so funny, Miranda, when you're talking about benefits? It seems to me that there are so many things in life that people and companies try to always razzle-dazzle you and make you think, oh, look, we're going to give you tuition reimbursement or something, in the same way that I know that we have had this disagreement in the past about the points you get for using your credit card. But at the end of the day, the companies, they're not losing money on this. It's not no one's a volunteer and giving a free gift. They've figured out a system so that it's good for them. It turns out that by doing it, they're giving you some gift, and it muddies the water. It's another way that sometimes people talk about whole life insurance. You know, they're combining savings with insurance. Well, either you need insurance or you need savings. Don't put it all together. And I'm concerned that when people take a job because of the benefits, they really get tied into that job because they need the benefit or something. And it's a way that employers can kind of, I mean, good for the employers, let them do whatever they want to woo people and keep them on board. But I think as an employee, you just have to bring everything down to how many dollars is this worth in my pocket today and do that calculation and try not to look at it in terms of, oh, it's a benefit, or I get a car with work, or I get, you know, health insurance. Well, how much is it worth to you? And do the calculation based on that.
All right. Good words of wisdom. Elsie finished the letter by saying, thank you for your help. Keep up the good work. You guys are awesome. Thank you, Elsie. You're awesome, too. And thank you for listening to us. And they also say, P.S., I'm not into, or at least not ready, to buy individual stocks, but I've bought one share of the Buzz Index through Robinhood, hence no fees, to support your work. Hey, thanks, Elsie. We really appreciate that. And speaking of Buzz, Miranda has a little bit more info for us.
Yes. Investors have not previously had a way to capitalize on the growth of big data and social media analytics and their impacts on the investment landscape. However, Buzz's methodology has proven that there is some potential to measure sentiment in a predictive manner using big data and social media. Buzz is the only investable solution that provides investors with a portfolio of securities that delivers exposure to large cap U.S. equities, which exhibit the highest degree of positive investor sentiment. So if you're interested in learning more about the Buzz Index and what you can do to invest, as our own Joe Salcihi does, and apparently as our listener does, head on over to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ.
Awesome. Thank you. Our next question comes from Craig. He says, I enjoy listening to the podcast and have learned lots, as well as get more motivated to spend time to plan how we invest our money. He has a couple of questions. One, he's been dollar cost averaging $200 a month into a mutual fund in a taxed account for several years now. It's grown to $100,000. Congratulations, Craig. These are actively managed funds and have fees in the 0.7 to 0.8 range and have provided around an 8% return. I was considering selling and reinvesting into funds with lower fees, or just stopping the monthly investment and focus that money into a lower cost fund. Thoughts if creating a taxable event is worth moving just to lower the fees? Also, how should I consider these funds in asset allocation as it relates to our retirement investment? Devin, do you want to tackle that one?
You know, it's hard to know without seeing some of the specifics here, but cost is generally only an issue if there's no value. So while I'm a strong advocate of using low-cost investing approach, and I generally stay away from most of the actively managed funds, there are some out there that have given off some very impressive performance numbers over the last several years. So just with this information here, I don't have enough data to make a suggestion, but you know, it could be worth his time to reallocate that into a lower cost. But moving forward, I think I would tend to do that anyway, certainly. But you know, I don't know. I'd have to do the math and see what kind of taxable event we're having. An 8% return, which is phenomenal, by the way. $200 per month has turned into $100,000. That's fantastic. So depending on what his long-term capital gain is, really is what would determine it for me.
Mm-hmm. All right, Doug, what do you say?
You know, I've had clients who come in and they, frankly, a lot of times it's like a widow and she inherited stocks from her husband 20 years ago. And he, you know, was a real genius and he bought four stocks and those four stocks have gone up in value a lot. And now she says, well, you know, what should I do? And the problem is she's got, let's say, $100,000 capital gain in that account. Now, if we sell it, it's going to be a huge capital gains tax. The problem is, what do you do? Because it's not the right portfolio for her. And I think in cases like that, it's a little more clear than, you know, compared to Craig's question, because in a case where you're in the wrong investment, like for this widow, she shouldn't have just owned four stocks. The answer was you had to bite the bullet, sell and pay the tax. But in your case, it's not so clear. First of all, I'm pretty impressed with the returns that you're describing. If you've been putting in $200 a month and now you have $100,000, that's not bad. I would not be so quick to get rid of it. It doesn't sound like it's the world's most expensive fund that you're paying based on the fees you're describing. So I don't think that should be your number one issue. Don't let the tail wag the dog here and say, well, you know, you guys on Money Tree Podcast always talk about fees, so therefore I've got to get to a lower fee investment. It's not true. I think what Devin said is accurate, that if you're getting value for what you're paying, you know, that's great. And the only other bit of advice I go for is vote for politicians who will lower your tax rate.
Well, I don't want to get too much off track here, Doug, but in your example, wouldn't the widow have a stepped up cost basis?
I said he died 20 years ago. I thought.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I missed that one. Okay,
no, but it's a good point. If he died yesterday, well, it's actually not even clear. A stepped-up cost basis. Great question. A stepped-up cost basis normally means that if you own a stock, let's say you paid 50 for it, and then it goes to 90, and then you die, so your heirs inherit it, and if they sold it the next day, it would be as if they bought it at 90, and they wouldn't have to pay any tax, presuming they sold it at 90. But it depends on whether the stocks are held in a joint account or whose name. But you're raising a great point, but that's why I said he died 20 years ago.
Got it. Sorry. Okay.
And Doug, to your point on the fees, I mean, you're absolutely right. If you have an actively managed fund that's 0.7 to 0.8%, that's not that high.
That's low.
Yeah, it's very low. So there's a lot of actively managed funds that are easily twice that amount. So, yeah. That alone is not enough reason for me to say, dump it.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely have had a market-based return at 8%, and 0.7, 0.8 isn't totally outrageous. Certainly, you know, I've seen a lot more expensive funds than that. And if they can continue that, you know, it seems like it could be a decent fund for them. Miranda, what do you think?
Oh, go ahead. Kind of a question, what you're saying. What would you tell the person? Let's say the client comes in and he says, listen, I am actually afraid the market's going to go down. And I'm not a market timer, but he has a legitimate reason. He says, I don't want to be in it because, you know, maybe in a few years I'll be buying a house with this money. And he says, so I'm concerned about that. The money then changes from being long-term money to short-term money. Would you say, okay, listen, let's just sell because, you know, and pay now? Or would you look for another strategy maybe to hedge the portfolio?
I mean, if their strategy changed from long-term to short-term, I would probably look to either sell or gradually sell to start protecting that money. Because once they have a short-term objective, then things really change focus. And if they're going to need a certain dollar amount to buy that house, then they've got to protect what they have. So then it becomes, you know, a move away from what are the fees to what's your objective with the money. And yes, I probably, you know, depending on when they chose to be buying that house, choose to sell it fairly soon. Yeah.
Thanks.
Miranda, anything to add here?
Nope.
Okay. All right. I think we've talked enough about that. They also have one more question. Through my employer, I have a good government pension that will guarantee me a significant portion of my current salary. I have focused my 403B to be more aggressive with more stocks, which the allocation is 35% large cap, 20% mid cap, 20% small cap, 20% international, and 5% bonds. Thoughts on this approach, knowing the pension provides stability for retirement income? Feel free to comment on my allocation on the 403B as well. I'm 48 years old and plan to retire around the age of 60. So, Devin, you want to tackle that one?
This is the benefit of doing more holistic financial planning, right? So if you're just looking at the 403B alone, that seems incredibly aggressive by itself. But you have this pension, which sounds like it's going to contribute more to his retirement income than this 403B will, because if he's 48 years old, he's contributing the max possible to the 403B. It's going to have to be very large before it can get up to where it can generate something that is equal to a salary as his pension will. And that pension's coming in, depending on where it's coming from, then yeah, I think that gives him that stability. The other part, so that could almost be looked at as the bond portion of the portfolio right there, where the 403B can make up the more aggressive part of the portfolio. So he may be right on track here. Depends on his other circumstances, but just looking at this, I don't have a problem with it.
All right. Miranda, what do you think of this allocation?
I agree. I don't think there's a huge problem with it. I think it offers some pretty decent diversity across, you know, sector, and also even some geographic diversity with the international. So like Devin, I don't see any huge problems, you know, barring any other issues with his portfolio or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right. And to give you an example here, so if you look at here in the Republic of Texas, where I live, there's a firefighters and police pension that's in a lot of trouble. So it's some of that, you know, these individuals are now very glad, if they had personal savings, that they have that money. Because the pension's in a lot of trouble, it's very uncertain. So some of it depends on the individual pension as well. If that pension has any issues, then he probably needs to be more conservative in his other savings. But again, it goes back to the safety of that pension and how funded it is.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, because there's actually a lot of pensions that are having trouble. And the reason is because of interest rates being so low. They were put into place assuming around an 8% long-term rate. And since interest rates went so low, they weren't able to meet that. And so a lot of pensions have been in trouble. And so it's great to not just rely on one source, but to diversify and try and get your own retirement plan as large as you can. So I think the 403B is aggressive, and I think that's probably a good plan for this portfolio. What do you think, Doug?
I just want to add on to this, because if you've ever gotten the Social Security statement, it says on the front page that we're going to run out of money in another, I forget, 15 or 20 years. So a lot of people say, don't worry, Congress will come along and they'll cooperate and they'll sign, you know, and figure it out. So the Social Security, which is sort of the mother of all pension plans in America, you know, is that really going to be okay? And if that's, and he says a government pension, it could be a local government pension. There are trillions of dollars of unfunded liabilities and pensions. So I'm going to agree with what Devin and Miranda said about it's okay that you have some money in the 403B aggressively invested because you have your pension. But I'm saying it from another reason. I'm saying because who knows if the pension is going to work out. You really better do something to try and build up your nest egg aggressively in order to make sure that you'll be able to cover yourself, because you can't count on anyone else. You can't count on the government. You can't count on the pensions. You got to take care of yourself.
Hey, Doug, I want to make a comment on something real quick. The Social Security statement actually does not say that we are going to be out of money. So that sounds like if you're getting a Social Security check, it's going to end in 2033. And that's not it at all. The Social Security Trust Fund is scheduled to be depleted at that time. And that's what holds the reserves from what's collected in taxes, what's paid out in benefits. So at that point, when those reserves have been depleted, there's going to be enough coming in Social Security taxes to pay out about 76% of the benefits that individuals are entitled to receive. Now, if a pension could make that same guarantee, if they could say, listen, worst case, when all of this goes to heck in a handbasket, we're going to be able to pay you 76%. That's not that bad of a deal, really, when you look at some of these pensions out there. But it was a little inflammatory saying that Social Security is going to be out of money. It's not. The trust fund is going to be depleted at that point.
Well, let's clarify something now, if we're just going to touch on this. That the numbers that you're quoting, I'm sorry, you were right, and I appreciate that you're spelling it out a little more clearly. That number, actually, that 70-whatever percent that you said, I can't remember the dates because I haven't really been saving these, but it used to be that they said, we'll get 90%, and then they lowered it down, and they've been lowering it over time. Is that locked in? Do you feel 100% confident that you would tell a client, don't worry, when 2033 comes, they're going to only pay you 75%? It's not going to be less than that?
No. If you look at the current population numbers, though, that's where they are. But a lot of things could change that. Wage growth will change that. The tax structure, which I think is almost certain to change, is going to change
immigration.
That. Right.
All those more people they got to pay, right?
Well, yes and no, but to receive a benefit, they're going to have to pay in as well. So
yeah, but no one's paying in nearly enough to keep the balance going, and people really are living longer. We've had people on the show talk about
that.
Well,
remember, Social Security is set up to be paid out of current receipts, though. You know, they're paying out of taxes that's being collected yesterday, you know. It's not paid out of something that, is going to be collected in the future.
Well, yeah, it could also help to raise the amount at which it's capped. I mean, right now, you know, I mean, I'm not paying Social Security taxes on all of my income. You know, it's capped at what is it now, $118,000? You're not, you know, it's fairly regressive right now, where you're paying a higher percentage of your income the less you make on Social Security taxes. So, I mean, if you wanted to extend it, you know, But now we're wandering into the weedy area of policy.
It's going to be difficult. It's
the rabbit trail.
It's going to require Congress going to work together.
And, it's going to require some work. And the bottom line is, like what we were talking about before, if you really want to make sure, and what we've talked about on this, and what we say at the end of our show every week, you know, you are going to have to take some responsibility for this and make sure that, you know, if you want to make sure that you have what you need, it's going to be on you. And can't wait for somebody else to come in and save Social Security.
Absolutely. It's going to come down to a couple of things. It's going to come down to either a benefit cut or a tax increase. And the truth is, it'll probably be a little bit of both of those.
Exactly. All right. On that note, it's probably a good place for us to finish up here since we're running out of time. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And Devin, thank you so much for being our special guest. You can reach Devin at his website, socialsecurityintelligence.com. And Miranda and Doug, I will see you next week. Thank you, as always. And Miranda, can you take us home from here, please?
Yes, make sure you check us out at moneytreepodcast.com. Send us your questions at contact@moneytreepodcast.com. We love to hear from you. And make sure you subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts. You can do that and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. We love reading your reviews. We love reading your questions. Let us know what you think by subscribing on iTunes and Stitcher. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.